you brought a book along around Tahlequah Council fires. So why did you bring that to our interview?
First of all, this is only one of about 100 copies that were made. It was written by a professor at the era that Northeastern Normal School, as it was first known, after it was the female seminary. T.O. Ballinger was a professor at that school. I got to meet him and hear a lecture from him in my first year of college. He was a phenomenal guy. He was teaching on that campus when it became a state college, and he wrote this book in 1935, and it is a collection of stories from Tahlequah, mostly focused on the Cherokee people, that were seminal moments that he thought would be important. The one that I wanted to share with you is, once again, directly related back to my family and to my treasurership. It's the chapter entitled A Cherokee Payment Tragedy. It says, on May 30th of 1894, Treasurer E.E. Starr, my grandfather, was accredited paymaster for the Cherokee government, passed through Fort Smith with $1 million in coin and paper money to pay the individual Cherokees their share of the large amount coming from the sale of the Cherokee Strip. He went with a strong guard to Fort Gibson. And by the way, John, there is a photograph of that disbursement at Fort Gibson. And if you look at all of the armed Cherokees there around the money, my grandfather, the treasurer's in the middle. But if you look to the far left-hand side of the photograph, there's a 10-year-old boy standing there. That's my great-grandfather, Charles Lucian Starr. It was kind of, you know, go with your dad to work day kind of a thing. The book goes on to say that he went with a strong guard to Fort Gibson and thrice to Tahlequah, where on Monday, June the 4th, the distribution commenced. The payment continued until Saturday, June 16th. Captain Cochran, with a guard of 50 well-armed men stationed around the treasurer's office during the payment, and goes on to talk about the fact that each Indian got $265.70 paid in gold, greenbacks, or checks as desired. A phenomenal man. Yeah. And there was absolutely no loss of funds during that entire distribution.
Did you work closely with Wilma Mankiller on certain projects?
Indeed. Wilma was very keen on the nation not being an island. And she, about 1990, created a thing called the Private Industry Council. And she went to various communities, Stillwell, Salisaw, all of the Grove. She went to all these major, either county seats or major towns and cities within the boundaries of the Cherokee Nation, which makes up, you know, is overlaid of 14 counties in northeastern Oklahoma. And there she would approach either municipal government or chambers of commerce. She said, how can the tribe work with you? You know, Wilma was a pan-cultural leader. She wasn't just, it's all about the Cherokee Nation. She realized that we all lived here together. And she asked if I would co-chair that council with her. And so we traveled about the Cherokee Nation, meeting with various entities. I think Wilma probably thought, you know, well, you're president of the bank here in Tahlequah. I'll need a banker, you know, someone who's not in the tribal government to maybe have a bit of cachet with economic development in the nation. So, yeah, we did a lot of interesting things to help grow partnerships between the economic prowess of the Cherokee Nation and established industrial parks or economic initiatives that were in these various towns within the Cherokee Nation.
What would you say is her greatest talents, abilities? How would you describe that?
Well, my Mankiller was a gatherer of people. Not, you know, if she were here seated with us today and we said, oh, here's, you know, you, ga, we, you, he, you know, Oscar Young, de, he, you know, this is chief, you know, Mankiller. She said, oh, I'm not really the chief. She said, I'm really a cheerleader for us. She had no hesitation and reaching for other tribes, reaching for non-tribal people, because she realizes, and people in the future may hear this and think, oh, he's just making a reference on a Democrat presidential candidate, but I'm not. I hate that she borrowed this title for her book, and I'm talking about Hillary Clinton, but she was right. It takes a village, and Wilma Mankiller knew that, and she saw to it that she built a village, not just in the Cherokee Nation, but literally around the country and around the world.
Charlie spoke so eloquently about the Bell Water Project.
Oh, yes, the great community of Bell.
So there's a gathering there.
There's a gathering there. And at a time when I would tell you that I don't know that the Cherokee citizenry that lived back in these rural communities, they saw the evolution of the tribal government as something new that I don't know that they understood or necessarily that they trusted. Remember, the Cherokee Nation as a government, it was Brigadoon. It had been in the mist since 1906. You know, we were not allowed to elect our own principal chiefs. Between 1906 and 1970, the President of the United States had the authority to appoint people to be principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. My great-great-uncle, William Wirt Hastings, W.W. Hastings, was appointed by FDR to be the principal chief in 1936 for one day. His appointment said, you will be the principal chief of the great and sovereign Cherokee Nation from sunup until sundown. And his entire job was to sign a deed to transfer a piece of tribal land to build the Indian hospital in Tahlequah. And once again, it shows the psychoses of the evolution of federal government. It's like, well, we're going to force allotment on you between 1898 and 1906, but then later on, we're going, well, but when we take your land away from you, we'll actually not steal it from you. We'll appoint your own chief to give it to us. 17 chiefs between 1906 and 1970 when we were allowed under Congressional Act or the Principal Chiefs Act to once again elect our own chiefs.
Does the federal government have any muscle or input on the Cherokee Nation to this very day?
I will borrow a phrase from an Arkansas school teacher in Timbo, Arkansas, who wrote the famous song, The Battle of New Orleans. I'm speaking of Jimmy Driftwood. Spent the afternoon with him. He's a phenomenal guy. In that song, it says, there wasn't as many as there was a while ago. And that's so very true today. The Constitution that I spoke of earlier, the federal government did not want to recognize our Constitution. They said, oh, well, we have to approve that. Oh, no, you don't, because we are an inherent sovereignty tribe. You see, we get to decide what our own Constitution is. And so for years between the actual recess of the Constitutional Convention in March of 1999, the actual establishment of the new 1999 Constitution wasn't until like 2006, because we battled with the federal government in actually agreeing to recognize that we had our own constitutional document that they had no authority to approve. And to this day, there continues to be this back and forth between self-governance and, of course, in this modern era, the McGirt case, the Murphy case. Very fortunate to be invited to continuing education at the OU Law School 4 weeks ago, which was totally focused on Indian law. And there, I spoke at the Sovereignty Symposium, which is operated by the Oklahoma Supreme Court in 2018, and warned people, mostly tribally at that time, is with the McGirt decision getting ready to come in from the Supreme Court, we should be careful as tribes and perhaps not chase the Greyhound bus. We may, in fact, catch it. But since then, there are 9 tribes in Oklahoma that have been determined by the courts were not disestablished after statehood, that their boundaries are, in fact, exactly what they were pre-statehood, and therefore the jurisdictional authority inside of those boundaries is as it was prior to the state of Oklahoma, meaning that tribal law and federal law are the primary plenary laws in those particular districts. And it's been contentious between the state of Oklahoma, our current governor, many municipalities. And at the same time, if we talked with the federal magistrates in the Northern District where you live in Tulsa, they'll tell you this is working just fine. We are hand in hand with tribal governments and maintaining their sovereignty in prosecuting cases that need to be prosecuted within these districts. This is not done yet. It is still a long, long walk, but it is one that if both tribes and if the state and if federal government will continue to take a page from Wilma Mankiller, and if they will gather and see what is in actuality, not only from history, but what will be in the future, this will work just fine.
I don't think you need any help from the federal government, do you?
We have treaties with the federal government and have since 1785, and they have obligations to us. We have obligations to them. We should both keep those obligations.
But the Cherokee Nation's in great shape today. I remember, I think it was it Ross Swimmer I interviewed, or Wilma, the issue of casinos became an issue. Which one would it have been?
Well, it was Wilma, and I was president of the bank in Tahlequah, and Wilma Mankiller called me, and she said, "Jay, I would like to come see you." And I said, "Well, yes, Chief, not a problem." She came with Tommy Thompson, who was the chief financial officer for the Cherokee Nation, and they sat down in my office right across from the Cherokee Square, which my fourth great-grandfather had burned to the ground during the American Civil War. He was the brother-in-law of General Stand Watie and company commander of Company H. And I'll get back, but you have to hear this side step, because we on the Star side of the family, we're urban developers there. The story goes that General Watie told my grandfather, Captain Starr, he said, "We have word the tribal council is going to capitulate the treaties with the Confederacy, and I need for you to ride into Tahlequah and persuade them to not do that." And my grandfather took Company H, and I believe it's in October 63, and he convinced them by burning the council house to the ground, and then he burned Tahlequah to the ground. And just to put some punctuation on it, they rode out to Park Hill and burned Chief John Ross's very fancy plantation-style home, burned that to the ground too, and kind of at least delayed their decision for a while. But when you look at gaming, and Wilma's seated there, and she says, "Jay," she says, we need to borrow some money at the tribe to build a bingo hall in Roland, Oklahoma. I said, "Wilma," I said, "you know, I've read our Constitution," and I said, "it actually says that the official depository of the Cherokee Nation is the First National Bank up the street, that my great-great-grandfather helped to found in the 1890s. And I said, "I'm pleased that you're here, but," I said, "how is it that you come to see me for these monies?" She said, "well, I went there and they've turned us down." And I said, "Wilma, why would they do that?" And she said, "because the vice president of that bank is a political enemy of mine, and he's not going to assist me in doing what I need to do to bring enterprise into the nation." I said, "how much do you need?" "Well," she said, $1,046,000. And I said, "and this is for a bingo parlor?" And she said, "yes." And I said, and then Tommy Thompson stepped in. He said, "you know, Jay," he said, "there's a loan program in the U.S. Department of Interior." And he said, "you could actually get a guarantee if you loaned us the money from the federal government." And I said, "how much would that guarantee be, Tommy?" He said, 90%. I said, "you know, we should get you an application today." Now, John, my lending authority was not over $1 million when I was the president in Tahlequah. So I actually had to come here to Oklahoma City, and I met with the chief credit officer of Bank First, and Bob Gregory, a phenomenal banker, still living, retired, and in his 80s, but a prince of a man. And he looked at me and he said, "Mr. Hanna, I see that you're wanting to loan a federally recognized Indian tribe over $1 million to construct a building in Sequoia County." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "And I understand that you can't take a mortgage on that piece of property because it's in something called Indian country." I said, "That is correct, sir." And he said, "And the only collateral that you have are tables and chairs and this thing called a ball popper and a couple of other items that are inside of this building." I said, "That is correct, sir." And he said, "And they don't equal $1,046,000. I said, "No, they do not." I said, "There's maybe $40,000 worth of collateral here." And he said, and plus, if we wanted to repossess those items, he said, "They have Indian marshals that could prevent us from going in to get that collateral." And I said, "Yes, sir, that is very true." And he says, "And you have a 90% guarantee from the federal government on this loan." I said, "Yes, sir, I do." And he said, "Let's sign that memo and get that casino built." And we did. And after that, then I was partnered with Wilma on the bingo parlor in Catoosa and another of our locations, which we went there for in West Siloam Springs, which, oh, that's right, John, it was within 2 miles of where I grew up. And I thought, here I am helping my tribe to build an economic engine on a place where I played as a kid. It was the old John Brown University Airport grounds. Later, I would be chairman of the board of all tribal enterprises and would build out multiple casinos for the Cherokee Nation, inclusive of that thing that you know of in Catoosa called the Hard Rock. Mm-hmm. And when I stepped out of the role in 2012 of being chairman of the board of Cherokee Nation businesses, I left them with, as I recall, $620-some-odd million a year in income, 22 companies that we diversified, because I kept telling the tribal council, it was a bad analogy, but at the time I thought it was great. I said, "I wish to be the Michael Corleone of the Cherokee Nation." I said, "You know, smoky bingo parlors in another 50 years from now or less may not be socially fashionable. We should have other businesses that have real services." So I took us into Department of Defense contracts. It did cause me to have to get a top secret military clearance, but we made latches for C-130s here at Tinker Air Force Base. We had programs at the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama, and those businesses combined helped to diversify away from gaming. And I'm told today by my tribal officials that our actual income to the nation from our enterprises is now more from non-gaming activities than it is from gaming activities.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is wonderful. Now, my analogy was bad because you'll recall in the Godfather movie that Michael Corleone was going to take the family legitimate by moving them from New York City to Reno to go in the gambling business. But they did kind of get out of the other business that they were in when they left.
Mm-hmm. Were you considered to be a running mate for Wilma VanKiller?
I only have a couple of letters in my safe deposit box. One is from Garrison Keillor, who invited me to be on the Prairie Home Companion after his producer, who was on vacation at Hot Springs National Park, saw me doing a program with some music and some storytelling, and he said, "Well, he'd be great for the program." And I turned them down, John, because I had no idea what the Prairie Home Companion was. And the other letter is from Chief VanKiller, and it was written to me in 1991. I'm president of the bank in Tahlequah, and it was a two-page handwritten letter. And she says, "Jay," she said, "I want you to be my running mate." And she said, "This will be the last time I'm going to run for chief. We'll run as a ticket. We will be elected and for do a four-year term." She said, "I will step out of the chief's position 2 years into our term, and you will become the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. And then after that, you can decide if you want to continue to be an Indian chief or if you want to do something else." And I did not sleep for 3 days, and I prayed hard about this, and my wife and I talked about it, and I talked with Gene Reinbold. I was on the Academy for State Goals at the time, and we had a meeting here on a Saturday morning at the California Street, I think, here in Oklahoma City. And Gene, of course, Wilma was brilliant. She'd already called Mr. Reinbold to say, "I'm offering Jay to run with me for chief." And he said, "Now, Jay," he said, "you know, that's an important job." But he said, "You know, I think you have an important job here at the bank." And he said, "You'll have to decide." And he did his hands in a Y shape. He said, "You have to decide if you're going to be a banker or an Indian chief." And I decided to be a banker. I don't think I'll regret that decision. Later on, not as a chief, and much as my ancestors, I don't have any chiefs in our family, but we have been advisors to chiefs, and we have been treasurers, and we have been people that have served the nation. And that's really, John, all I ever wanted to accomplish in the Cherokee Nation was to simply be able to cross the river at some point and to not have my ears pulled by my Cherokee grannies that I had somehow gone white in my life, that I had served my people. I think I could probably get over there and not have too much of a lecture from my Cherokee grannies.
So no regret at all by making that
None
decision.
Whatsoever. Wilma and I continued to be very close friends all the way up until her passing, and she called me to her bedside 3 days before she passed away. And
what were your words, your final words, you think?
My final words to her was that, of course, I asked her a question. You know, John, there's only like three people on the face of the planet that know this. It was a very private conversation. But I did ask her. I said, "Wilma," I said, "why are we friends?" I said, "I'm a light-skinned Cherokee from northern Adair County, and you're Wilma Mankiller. You get the Presidential Medal of Freedom hanging by your wood stove in the hallway." And she said, "Well, you're honest with money." And he said, "You're honest with people." And she said, That's all I've been looking for, is people to be honest with me and be honest with other people."
Hmm.
I did tell her, though, because she looked at me. She'd maybe had a little morphine at that point. And she said, "Jay, I'm going out into space." I said, "Yes, Wilma, you are." And I've read that the theory of physics is the further that you get away from gravity, time slows down. And I said, "You know, Wilma, by the time you get across the river, I said, if you get your socks off to get them dry, I said, I'll be there right behind you, and I will join you across the river, and we will do more things together."
Mm.
And she said, "I will see you there."
Yeah. I have tears right now. So do you. That's something. That's good.
She's a good woman.